This is a special presentation from 90.5 WESA. On Tuesday, September 11th, WESA held a community forum on preparing children for the jobs of the future when we don't know what those jobs might be. Panelists include Dr. Justin Alio, Director of Academic Achievement and District Innovation at the Montour School District, Dr. Maria Kalevich, Dean of the School of Engineering, Mathematics, and Science, and Acting Provost for Innovation at Robert Morris University, and Allison Treister, Director of Workforce Business Engagement, the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. The forum was held at the Pittsburgh Community Broadcast Center on the South Side, and it was moderated by WESA education reporter Sarah Schneider. The public was invited to attend and participate in the discussion. Tonight, WESA presents that conversation. It was edited for time.
Allison was also one of the authors of the Inflection Point Report, and that was released in 2016. And that's largely why we're having this conversation tonight. That's why I was really interested in this topic, and we chose to have one of our panels on this. The report outlined, you know, workforce challenges facing Western Pennsylvania counties. And I'll let Allison tell us more about that study in a moment, but I want to give us kind of a framework for this conversation and explain really why we're here tonight. You might hear some jargon during this conversation, STEM, makerspace, things like that. But I also want to make sure really that we're focusing this conversation around students, because we want to remember that, you know, there are a lot of people trying new things and new ideas in school districts. And some of those ideas should be challenged, but also, you know, they're doing this with the same goal in mind to prepare students for the future and set them up for success. And it's pretty obvious that educators didn't just start thinking about workforce development because of this report. But as a reporter who's in education spaces often, a lot of people said this was really a wake-up call for some of them to start thinking about how we should think about education spaces and the reasons that we're here for students. So it's been a few years now since that report was released, and it has been updated. So now seems like a good time to reflect on what has changed and what still needs to happen to help students with their future needs. So Allison, we will start with you. Can you help, you know, get us up to speed on the Inflection Point study and how, you know, it was 100 pages long. So really, what should educators take from that report?
Thanks. So I think to start, it's just important to kind of understand the impetus behind the report. And that was that our membership really said, looking forward, workforce is our number one challenge. It's our number one pain point. And how can we kind of map what our challenges are and map a road forward for what we can do to better bridge the gap between educators and businesses and make sure that the workforce of the future is prepared for those jobs? And so we, as the conference, undertook a series of focus groups with 125 CEOs and HR directors and asked them, you know, tell us what you see as the top skills that you need. Tell us what the jobs of the future look like. And then we paired that with information from a group called Burning Glass Technologies out of Boston, which is the largest consumer of job postings. They scrape about 50 million job postings a year from job boards, and they're able to parse that information and really pull out what are the top educational requirements, what are the years of experience, what are the skills that employers are looking for. And we were able to match those two up and really see that there was some conflict between what employers were saying they wanted and they needed and what they were actually putting in the job postings. And so we're seeing things like upskilling and up-credentialing, where those aren't really necessarily required for the position, but that's how they were being posted. And so as a result, we're losing talent because they don't feel like they're qualified. We, for example, we lose 40,000 college students every year. We graduate 40,000 college students every year. We lose 20,000 of them to other regions.
And that's in Allegheny County.
That's in the 10-county region. So there's 61 institutions of higher education post-secondary in the 10-county region. We're losing about 20,000 of them. And largely that's due to the fact that students say they graduate and they can't find a job. But we know we have over 25,000 open jobs in the region, so clearly there's a mismatch between what employers are looking for and their willingness to take a chance on fresh outs and what they're putting in their postings. In addition to that, and I think this is the most applicable piece from a K-12 standpoint, is what skills are in high demand? What are employers looking for? We know that communication is the number one skill across any industry that employers are looking for. As things are becoming more customer focused, take healthcare for example, healthcare companies are now really seeing patients as long-term customers. And so those communication and the more that healthcare goes into the home and the more that communication and wraparound services are becoming a part of the everyday engagement, those communication skills become even more important. Leadership development. We know in our region especially, we're hourglass shaped, so we have a lot of young people and we have a lot of baby boomers who are going to be retiring. And that middle Gen X that left when the steel industry collapsed is really lacking in terms of leadership. So making sure that we have pipelines for leadership development and making sure that people are ready to step into those roles. Critical thinking and problem solving skills are another huge thing that employers are asking for. And that connects itself to technology and nimbleness and agility and the ability to be a lifelong learner and really have a willingness to come to work every day and want to learn something new. As we see how quickly and how heavily technology is impacting careers across the board, it's really important that we make sure that our students are becoming tech savvy and tech enabled and are willing to be and able to be continuous learners.
So you mentioned a couple of skills that employers are looking for, like critical thinking, which I know a lot of K-12 educators talk about developing that in children. But I guess, I hear a lot of people say, we're not sure what jobs will look like in 10, 15 years. What do they mean when they say that? Like, what industries are actually going to be in need of employees?
So that was the other thing that the inflection point really called out is what are the high demand occupations specifically for our region? And we know that the most explosive growth is going to be happening in IT and computer science, engineering, business, and healthcare, given our large medical presence here. And I think that's the importance of those kind of, we'll call them baseline skills, but the critical thinking, the technology, the ability to be an ongoing learner is that we don't know in many cases what those jobs of the future are going to be. And so if we can kind of have these skills to be able to continue to adapt and learn and innovate as the jobs come up, then we'll be able to be prepared for those. Again, the workforce that's currently here as well needs to be willing to upskill and continue to learn. And there are a lot of great programs with post-secondary institutions like RMU who are working with businesses to create tailored programs to be able to provide companies with those skills. But in terms of, the industries locally that are really exploding, that the job titles are being created as we speak, you look at the autonomous industry. We have 6 companies right now in Pittsburgh, 2 with active fleets on the road. The robotics industry also is impacting the healthcare community. When you think of robotics and surgery, it's also impacting advanced manufacturing, the autonomous sector. And so you're really seeing a hybridization of skills as, for example, you have the consumer roles in robotics and autonomous, for example, your traditional engineering roles who are building things. But then you have the technician roles on the other side where you have to understand a car from a traditional mechanic technician standpoint, but you also have to understand the software that's being embedded into those cars as well. So how do we make sure that people are getting these new kind of hybridized skill sets to be able to work on these jobs of the future?
So to follow up with that, so these jobs just might look a little different than what we're used to now. So for example, like advanced manufacturing isn't necessarily going to be just welding, right? It's programming and things like that. So I wanted to ask Maria, so you're at Robert Morris University in enrollment in engineering, mathematics, and science, 3 components of STEM. Enrollment there has been growing, and that school for many years has been known for business and nursing. So I'm just wondering, the students that are going into these fields, and Robert Morris also has a high population of local students, from the Pittsburgh region. Why did those students want to pursue those fields? What are you hearing from them?
That's a very good question. And in case of RMU, you're absolutely right. Historically in the region, everyone thinks that this is a business school, but we really have five various schools, and one of the schools that I chair is the School of Engineering, Mathematics, and Science. Not many people know that we actually have the only accredited degree in manufacturing in the state of Pennsylvania. And we started our school exactly 20 years ago with 22 students, and we now have about 1,000 students. So as you can see, the interest in manufacturing and engineering in general is certainly growing. And the special emphasis is on 3D printing and additive manufacturing, which is a new type of manufacturing that is explored right now with the students and also industry. We have been working with the industry very closely, and as Allison mentioned, all that skills are essential because that's what industry demands. Another very important piece that industry demands is actually teamwork. And for that reason, we're making sure that our students are working on projects, real-life projects that come from companies, and they work in teams, and that various interdisciplinary teams, people with backgrounds in engineering and also arts and design and computer sciences, so everyone brings various expertise to solve the problem. And that's a basic motto for engineers: we solve problems. Mm-hmm. Another piece that I wanted to bring here, a piece of information, is you're absolutely right. The majority of the students, about half of them, do leave the region. But RMU draws its students from the 10-county area, and really 85% of our students stay in the region. So we proudly say that we are a workforce hub for the region in the sense of engineering and healthcare. Mm-hmm. And mathematics and sciences as well, but engineering in particular.
Okay. So you talked about working together and teamwork. So I will ask you to talk to us a little bit, Justin, about the Remake Learning Network, because I think that feeds into, you know, if you don't know, the Remake Learning Network is a large group of organizations, educators that work together to try to make sure that they're meeting the needs of students where they are now. And you've been really involved in that. So I'm just wondering if you could, you know, tell us a little bit about what you've seen change in education in the last several years as this group has, you know, intentionally been trying to figure out how to prepare students for jobs of the future.
Yeah, I think Remake Learning is a perfect example of teamwork. You know, it's 500 plus organizations in Western Pennsylvania and West Virginia, you know, really promoting the collaboration, this giant ecosystem of formal educators, informal educators, community organizations, all working together to try to, like you said, figure this out. And I think that's the key. And I know that Allison talked about having to adapt. And I think that's one thing that Remake Learning in school districts, we have to continue to be nimble. I think that's one thing we always say over and over again, be responsive to our community, because we don't know what the jobs look like. We don't know what education is going to look like. But we have to be nimble. I was recently asked by a reporter from the Post-Gazette. He said, all these things you're doing at Montour and in the region, are you afraid taking these risks? Like, are you afraid it's not going to work out? I said, I'm actually afraid that for school districts that are not taking these risks and for the kids that have to suffer in classrooms in straight rows and just hear the same thing over and over again. I mean, those are the things I'm afraid of. Schools that don't have access to technology, where we know it's so critical to have that access, or work on those collaboration skills or teamwork skills.
So what are some of the risks that you've had to take?
Yeah, so that's the fun part, right? Launching this fall at Montour, we launched the first artificial intelligence program in the country. So we partnered with Carnegie.
For what grades?
We're starting out fifth through eighth grade, and we're going to expand K through 4, 9 through 12. Mm-hmm. Working with Carnegie Mellon on autonomous robotics, working with MIT on AI ethics, working with corporations and partnerships like Amper Music and Anki, some large companies, and AI for All. And, you know, no, we don't know how it's going to go, you know, but all the students at the school will be exposed to it. It's not just for a gifted class or something. This is for all students will be exposed to it. We think it's going to go well. And kind of, it's funny, I was sitting in my living room one night with my 11, 9, and 6-year-old. I'm thinking, like, I don't know, with this AI program, and there's so many things we could touch upon. And I'm watching a show of Double Dare, you know, they got slammed on Nickelodeon, and they're asking all these questions, and they ask one question. They said, what computer science term, what does AI mean in computer science? They're like, boom, artificial intelligence. I'm like, holy cow. And I went to school the next day and asked a group of kids, what's AI, artificial intelligence? And they were explaining it to me. And it made me think one time to my 11-year-old son. I said to him, I said, you know, Google's not always going to be around. You know, like, you have to know things. So you have to know who the 16th president is. You have to know what 9 times 9 is, like that. He goes, Dad, Google's older than me. Relax. You know, I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, you're right. And so, like, to this generation, it is different. And mm-hmm. I think when kindergartners come to kindergarten, you know, they're growing up holding a mobile device or a smartphone or something in their hands before they could walk. And when they come to kindergarten, we're like, put that down, hold this number two pencil. For the first time, that's like the first time these kids hold a number two pencil. So we're still trying to force them into this society that doesn't really exist anymore. And I think another thing schools can do a lot better to take risks is open your doors. A lot of people say, like, how do you get partnerships? How do you get this? Montour School District last year had 115 school districts visit our school. And when school districts came in, we didn't show them all the nice things we have. We also showed them the challenges and issues we have every single day. And I say, who has a challenge? Who has a solution to this challenge? And majority of the time, someone raises their hand and says, I can help you with that. But I think schools are still kind of stuck in this thing where we can't show because we don't want to show this classroom or show this what's going on here. So we have to get over that. And that's how we got our greatest partnerships at Montour. We opened the first Lego lab in the world with Legos, president coming in last spring. Mm-hmm. We opened the first Minecraft lab in the world with Minecraft. And people are saying, well, how do you teach with Minecraft? Or, I don't know, but you know what? Kids love it, you know? And those days of kids getting up Saturday morning to watch cartoons and run down the steps, they're gone. My 11, 9, 6-year-old, they run downstairs, they grab Minecraft, they make slime. And if the parents are here, you know what slime is. Then they play cardboard boxes. All that stuff, STEM and STEAM activities. Mm-hmm. And so when we, you know, look at a school day, we want kids to run in the building. We want kids not to leave, because at the end of the day, if they're happy, teachers are happy, learning will occur. I promise you that. So we just have to make school fun and relevant, include all those skills. You know, we don't teach just Minecraft and gaming. We, you know, we teach engineering concepts, or we actually write the engineering lesson plans for Minecraft. A really neat quick story is, you know, at the end of the school year, we thought to ourselves, like, I wonder if this Minecraft thing really worked. And then I got a random phone call from Carnegie Mellon University's graduate program of Masters of Mechanical Engineering, saying our students used Minecraft all semester, and your third, fourth graders, we heard, are really the Minecraft experts. Can you come judge your end of the semester projects? I was like, ah, yes. And so I called the parents up and said, you're coming on the tour with us too. We took parents and students down, and students judged master's students programs at Carnegie Mellon, their engineering program. So we teach a lot of different things like that. And it's fun. But I will say one thing. You can teach skills. You can teach programs and curriculum. But if you don't have the mindset to do it, from the top, from the bottom, all the way back up to the top, it's not going to work. And that's the kind of the key, too, is you have to have that mindset that we're going to try it. We're going to try it together. It may not work, but we're going to learn along the way. And that's what school is. School's learning.
Right.
This is a special 90.5 WESA presentation of a community forum on tomorrow's jobs for today's students. The forum is moderated by WESA's Sarah Schneider. We now rejoin their conversation.
As an education reporter, when I go into schools, a lot of times the first thing the principal shows me is the makerspace, right? Mm-hmm. And this is where kids are supposed to tinker and learn new concepts, and it incorporates a lot of things. And you talked about the artificial intelligence curriculum. And sometimes I think people push back on that a little bit because they're like, we're just chasing the shiny new thing in education, right? And like, what are kids actually getting from this? What skills are they developing? So I'm wondering if any of you want to jump in on, you know, you mentioned skills that are needed in our region that we need to develop for the workforce. So at the K-12 level, when you're seeing these things of, you know, this big push for STEM learning in these kind of creative new ways, what do you think kids are getting from that? You know, how can they use that beyond just making, I guess?
Well, just a couple of things I would mention. First of all, we often ask, what are the jobs of tomorrow? But we also need to ask, who will be teaching our students tomorrow? So what skills do our teachers and faculty need to have for our students to be successful? And we all know that K through 12, universities also work closely with the K through 12 programs, because we see that as a strong pipeline that comes to our disciplines. And very often the interest in STEM is sparked at the very early age. You're absolutely right when you mentioned that for your elementary school and middle school, and then often when they are in the middle school, we heard they lose the interest. So we have to maintain that interest. We have to make sure that there are activities and engagement and involvement for our students that make them feel excited about what STEM is about. And then later, when they are in high school and choosing their career, it could be a four-year degree, it could be a two-year degree. It could be a certificate program, it could be badges, it could be stacking of credentials. There's so many opportunities for students to get those skills, not just through one path, but there should be several pathways. And there are several consortia in the area that actually understand the importance of creating that model of collaboration between faculty, students, universities, industry, and I think that's the future when people look at things holistically from the from the various standpoints of view.
So in 2015, part of the Remake Learning, I had the opportunity with other Remake Learning members to go to the White House for the presidential roundtable discussion on maker education. And we talked about maker culture, not so much maker spaces. And so when we came back to Montour, we didn't have any maker spaces or anything yet. So we said, well, let's build a maker space, but let's focus on maker culture. So what we did was we had some parents and some teachers. We brought them to this empty space in the building. It was like 8:30 in the morning. And I said, we're going to build a maker space in this one space. And they said, what's a maker space? And I was like, I gave them a general definition. And they said, how much money do we have? I said, we don't have any money. And they said, where's our furniture? I said, we don't have any furniture. Where are the supplies? I said, we don't have any yet. I said, well, what's our timeline? How many months? I said, 3:30 today, we're going to finish this baby. And so what are we going to use? I said, well, let's go around the school and figure out how kids get excited about learning. So we kind of went around the school and picked up a couple of different things, and I took the group out for lunch, and there was a Barnes & Noble's next door, and I said, let's go get some inspiration over there. And the general manager came out and said, you know, what are you guys doing? I said, we're looking for inspiration. She goes, here, take this Lego table. We're not using it anymore. And I was like, Jim, go get your truck. It's loaded up in the truck. So we came back. We set this room up by 3:30. It was beautiful. Everything we had in the building. And then we had an organization come in to evaluate learning that took place in this one makerspace. And I said, we're going to look at that makerspace. I want to show you something really cool after that. So we went to this makerspace, and he had this measurement tool of learning in this makerspace. He's like, oh, there's a lot of learning going on. I was like, here, let's go take a look at something else. We walked around to every single classroom, and every single classroom had their own little makerspace in the classroom. And I said, he goes, how did this happen so quick? And I was like, our teachers, when we hear makerspace, I think sometimes they get like, well, that's not my classroom. Let's go to the makerspace and have fun. But we wanted to show teachers that you're already doing this maker learning in their class. And I think a lot of times that as your administrator, if you just say, try something different, here's how to do it, teachers are awesome and they'll do it. They really love and do whatever's best for kids. But it's often up to the school or society to let the teacher say, okay, do this. And they'll come up with these great things. And there's great ecosystems in Pittsburgh, like the STEM ecosystem, and organizations like Carnegie Science Center and the Children's Museum that really help those educators or administrators who don't know what to do, they step out and help them too. Kind of going back to Pittsburgh as an awesome resource for that.
I will open up the floor to anyone who wants to ask any questions. We want to hear from you. Is there anyone?
Sure. My name is Lucas Bezerra. I'm actually an organizer for Our Kids, Our Commitment. And I wanted to ask the question to you guys about public funding and what is actually, from your perspective, the current state. Is there enough public funding for STEM education and the demands that are really on this region? And if we are actually using those public funds, if they're sufficient enough to support the demands?
So I can't speak to public funds, but I can talk a little bit about corporate engagement and corporate investment. One thing that the Allegheny Conference has been working on is to better bridge educators and businesses and just their relationships in general. So what we heard from the K-12 community was we get a lot of one-off requests to come to our school or engage in some way, but we don't have the resources to really get our arms around all the different requests. And from the corporate community, they said, we'd like to make some targeted investments. We don't necessarily know how to access the K-12 system. So we've been working to really kind of help connect them in a better way. And we actually just recently formed a K-12 business engagement subcommittee that Greg Baer from the Grable Foundation is chairing to come up with some different ways that we can excite CEOs and get corporate people more invested in education and more aware of what's going on so that they can be better informed to assist with policy decision making and just general engagement. There are a lot of companies out there, though, that are making significant investments in STEM and project-based learning, and we're actually working on a mapping project right now to see where those investments are, where the gaps are, where there's duplication, so that we can improve access to some of these communities who don't have either public dollars, access to public money, or their own resources to be able to fund this type of work so that potentially corporate dollars can be spent there, you know. Justin mentioned the Grable Foundation, Remake Learning, the Benedum Foundation have put a lot of money into fab labs and other maker spaces throughout our community, which has really, I think, made Pittsburgh a unique, and the 10-county region, a unique area in terms of access to those types of resources.
I can only comment, because we're a private institution, I don't know enough about public funds, but I can comment that local foundation really are dedicated to make sure that there is an equity in accessing resources for schools here in Pittsburgh region and really in tri-state area, West Virginia and Ohio as well. And I know Benedum Foundation is working now with RMU to develop modules for teachers on engineering, like additive manufacturing in particular, and to teach the teachers and then get that back to the classroom, get that back to the various schools that will be engaged in this type of activities. So I do want to comment about foundations being responsive in the industry as well to the needs of STEM education in the region.
Well, Pennsylvania, you know, it's 500 school districts and funding's not, you know, fair. It's just straight up. And you have some school districts where the largest employer is the school system in the whole school district. And you have some school districts next door that have three Fortune 500 companies. And the taxes coming in are just so lopsided from both school districts. But I think, you know, Pittsburgh is such a unique place where we have, thank goodness, a lot of foundations and corporations that step up. And I can tell you out of the maybe 10 school districts that I know that are underserved of public funding, there's a foundation or corporations that's trying to help that school district.
Okay, we have another question in the front.
Hi, my name is Maureen Anderson. I'm with Refocused. And I recently read a really interesting 2012 book that said that was called The Half-Life of Facts. And it spoke about in the early 1900s, an engineering degree would stay current, half of that knowledge, for 35 years. And in 1960, it went down to 10 years. And currently, we're at 5 to 2.5 years, half of everything that those folks have learned is no longer relevant. If you couple that with the advance in technology and what the Allegheny Conference has determined is non-fact-based learning that the students need, like communication and teamwork and problem solving, how are we changing education to meet those needs, especially for those most marginalized students that have the least access to those new jobs?
So I'll just step up about a best practice and the best way to kind of address us. We think is, you know, at the elementary level, we try to get kids to ask a lot of questions, get curious, discovery. In fact, we name our school, we have two schools in one big school called School Discovery, School Curiosity. We want kids to ask questions, how, why, how does this work? At the middle school, our goal was to get kids to look underneath the hood, touch, feel, you know, how does this work? Actually tinkering a lot of things and kind of really getting deep in those skills. At the high school is where it gets fun. We really try to promote kids to really self-advocate for themselves and have a lot of student agency. So we got rid of our BEL systems. We have no BEL systems anymore at our high school, a school of 1,000 kids. You know, there's prisons have BELs. Why are we putting BELs in school systems? And then we have kids pick their own class they want to take. Teachers teach their own class they want to teach every single day in the middle of the day for 99 minutes, three periods. They take whatever lunch they want to eat. If they want to eat first lunch that day, they get on their phone, first lunch that day. If they want to take a second, take their test over again, they take their test over. If they don't want to take a test, they can go to a classroom called the Speak to Me room and talk to a counselor because maybe they broke up with their significant other. And a lot of people, high school teachers, think, well, you'll get over it. You'll have a lot of boyfriends or girlfriends. But for a high school kid, you know, that's a tough thing to go over. So, you know, when we look at preparing kids for the workforce, you know, we have to teach them in school how to use a cell phone, you know, in school. Because when they get to a job, when they get to a college, they're not going to get detention for using a cell phone. So we got to teach them how to use those things. We got to teach them how to, you know, if class is over, go to class. Don't wait for the bell to tell you when it's time to go. Make your way there. Take what classes you want to take. You know, sign up for things you want to do. We took all of our after-school clubs and put them during the daytime now. And the first time we did this, it's called personalized learning time. We let kids and teachers teach whatever they want to teach. And the first day we did this, two teachers stepped up, and they said, we're going to do a random acts of kindness club and see if anybody shows up. 125 students showed up on the first day. The Random Acts of Kindness Club is the largest organization at Montour School District. Hundreds of students now. And it's not that we told the students to do this. It's that they want to do this. So there's a lot of good things going on. But I think that taking those skills and those things, those careers that or degrees that are expiring, if we get students take ownership of their own learning at a younger age before they get to college and have to learn all that stuff, I think that goes a lot. I mean, you hear two things colleges say. Kids have poor time management and need to take on more responsibility. Well, let's teach those things early and get those things ingrained in them so when they get to college, they can, you know, find some organizations to get involved and take what classes they want to take because mom and dad's not going to be there or grandma or anybody. It's going to be they're on their own. So we got to teach that young and get them a lot of student agency involved in that.
So I cannot agree more. You certainly have to prepare them at the very early age. But you also brought a very interesting point. And the point is that technology is developing so fast and things are changing so fast. So the skills that we give our students today may not be relevant in 5 or 7 years or even less than that. So what do we do about that? I think there is another component to it along with the student quality and student skills. The component is certainly who teaches the students, who is the faculty, who is the teacher, and what is the professional development for those to stay current in their field. So that's an important piece as well. We at RMU, as you have heard, I have a very long title. So one part of my responsibility is innovation. So we at RMU were thinking about that because our faculty come to us with degrees that they obtained maybe 5 or 10 years ago, and they have some industry experience. It's one of the requirements because that's essential for them to stay current. So we are now looking into the program that is called embedding faculty into industry, giving them an opportunity to actually learn from industry the skills that I needed for tomorrow, for now and for tomorrow, and then bring it back to the classroom and introduce that into the curriculum. So this is the part that I think is very crucial, and we have to consider it, and not to forget about that, that along with the qualities that we install in our students, we also need to make sure that our teachers and faculty have the right preparation and the right knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Great answer.
I will ask this. We have another question from the audience. Kind of touches on what you were just talking about. Can you expand on how students should prepare for a career of lifelong learning in light of the fact that it appears that in the future they will likely not have one job for long periods of time with one company?
That's really an excellent question because we often think about the first job and we don't always talk about the career. And I think it's the responsibility for the university, because I'm talking from the university standpoint of view right now, to make sure that students are successful in their lifelong learning and their career and in their well-being. There is a well-known Gallup-Purdue survey that is done with students and alums of various institutions in the nation. And they have found out that there are six major components that not only contribute into the success of students during the college years, but also contribute into the success of students in their career and their physical and mental health in general, and satisfaction in life. So this Gallup-Purdue index or survey identified those six areas, and one is strong mentorship programs. Someone at the university level or school level who paid attention to the student and took interest and cared about the student. The semester-long research project that someone has done with the faculty and was able to present those data at the conference, or something like that. So things of that nature, that special attention, care, mentorship, is also an important part of how we educators affect the skilled workforce of the future and prepare them for their lifelong well-being and mm-hmm. learning.
And that transfers into K-12, right? When a teacher takes you under their wing, you're more likely to succeed, I suppose.
This is a special 90.5 WESA presentation of a community forum on tomorrow's jobs for today's students. The forum is moderated by WESA's Sarah Schneider. The panelists are Dr. Justin Alio, Director of Academic Achievement and District Innovation at the Montour School District; Dr. Maria Kalevich, Dean of the School of Engineering, Mathematics, and Science, and Acting Provost for Innovation at Robert Morris University; and Allison Treister, Director of Workforce Business Engagement, the Allegheny Conference on Community Development.
This question brings up a very good point that I'm glad we're going to address. African-American students are 7 times more likely to be suspended in school. Are there any innovative initiatives that you've witnessed or heard of through your work that are being developed to thwart suspensions? And how are the arts and STEAM being implemented to instill in school infractions and early social workforce, early training initiatives? So I think the question is really, how are we using this way to keep kids interested in school as a way to, thwart suspensions?
May I just start answering, because it's a very important matter and issue for us in STEM disciplines in particular, because we want to attract more African-American students to our disciplines, more females to our disciplines. And for many of us, it's a strategic approach to things. It's not an easy task, but the same level of excitement that we need to create in here, the important part also is to create the infrastructure that not only brings student to the university or high school or middle school, but also helps the student to thrive and helps student, showcase the best of his or her abilities. That really takes a village for someone to be successful. And for us at the university, we have numerous initiatives. Just this past Saturday, and I'm looking here because I see familiar faces, we had an event that supported interest in STEM disciplines for about 60 to 80 students, minority students, African-American students in our STEM disciplines. And the format was actually a fun format. It was like speed dating with professionals. So they spent about 5 to 10 minutes at one table speaking to various professionals in STEM disciplines, and then moved to another table speaking to other professionals. The event itself was about 3 to 4 hours, and we have heard nothing but really good responses about that. So this is just one example, but overall, it's a systematic, strategic approach. It has to create the right support system, the right infrastructure that help people to thrive.
I think also before I was at Montour, I opened up several different charter schools up and had an opportunity to do that and worked in some areas where students came and school wasn't successful for them. And so instead of looking at like what we need to do or how we need to do things, we first looked at why we're doing this and what works for students. And so little things like, you know, teaching biology and chemistry to high school students. You know, we talked to, surveyed the class, and two out of the 25 students in the class, they had a relative to go on to college, where 23 really didn't. So, you know, we looked at, well, let's get them, let's get rid of some classes, let's get rid of AP, let's get students in CCAC, all students in their junior year, give them a study hall when they come back so they can experience college, be successful at it. In science classes, we didn't teach on Fridays. We did something similar. We invited engineers and scientists in for coffee and cookies with students, just to say these are humans, you know. They talked and get students to really understand what science is. We had an issue of tardies and attendance. So we did traditional homerooms. We got rid of those, and for the first half hours of the day, we had our clubs at the beginning of the day, and we offered clubs, and we had students pick those clubs. Our enrollment went up a lot. We looked at, and we were small enough where we looked at saying, like, we actually interviewed our juniors and seniors, and we said, what's one thing you really want to do right now? And one kid, I remember one kid, his name's Troy, he said, I want to own my own business, and here's everything I want to do. So we gave him a class, and we gave him his own office, and one of our offices said, run your own business here. You don't have to take this class anymore.
So we've addressed some of the challenges tonight facing our region. I want to talk a little bit about solutions, which we've mentioned a few. But Allison, I'm wondering if you could just tell us, you know, some of the what are some of the actions that have been taken by local school districts that followed the Inflection Point report, this study that, you know, outlined the what's going to be available in the needs in our region. You know, are there districts that have taken this and run with it?
So I'll just make a general comment that I think we were pleasantly surprised at how quickly educators responded to the Inflection Point report. We kind of thought, you know, education has a lot of bureaucratic red tape and turning the ship is challenging. And we found that they were actually much more quick to respond to the data and say, we've been waiting for this type of information to know what's in demand and what skills employers are looking for. And that's not an indictment against the employer community, but the education community was much more quick to respond, from post-secondary all the way down to K to 12. So Pittsburgh Public Schools, for example, put it into their work plan and really took Inflection Point to heart, looking particularly, you mentioned career and tech ed programs, and they've aligned their healthcare, their HVAC, their first responders. That programming is now not only in alignment with what skills we're looking for, but it's also in alignment with CCA programming so that students are able to get credit while they're still in high school and can continue to have upward mobility if they decide to pursue their education because of that relationship with CCAC. Chartiers Valley, and again, this comes back to equity, and they have significant funding, but they're doing some amazing things there where they actually said, you know, the old model of kind of putting the CTE kids in the shop in the back corner where nobody ever sees them is over. And they put their advanced manufacturing lab and their CTE program right in the middle of the school. It's completely glass, so you can see into it. And on a day-to-day basis, students can see, you know, the maker spaces and what people are doing and what they're working on. They've got robotics. They have all kinds of different technology there. Montour is obviously doing a lot of really great things. So those are just two examples in a field of a lot of different examples. But I think, and I hope that because we have access to this information of where our regional challenges are and kind of how we have a road forward, that we're a little bit ahead of the game of other regions who are looking to us now and saying, we need to map our own challenge. How did you go about doing this? And so we hope that people will continue to use the resource and continue to build partnerships to continue to improve K to 12 business engagement and kind of how they can all support each other from a student perspective where they're learning the right skills and from an employer perspective where they have the workforce they need going forward.
We have two daughters who are very good at music, art, writing, speaking, their STEM isn't right there. So when you say you like to see teams with artists and designers, what exactly are you talking about, and how do those people get the education they need to participate in that?
We have developed a specific curriculum that we all know is called STEAM, where arts and are included in sciences and engineering. We have several courses that usually students who are interested in arts can take, and one of the courses is actually called Music and Mathematics, because there is a lot of similarities between mathematics and music. So this is an opportunity for the students to actually get excited what STEM is about and why we are comparing music and math. There is also a lot of interest between chemistry, and which is another STEM disciplines, and let's say perfumes or makeup, how it's made, why it is about chemistry. And so we are engaging kids at all levels, starting with elementary school. Another piece that is important, that we also engage parents, especially at elementary and middle school level. So when families come together to our events and we educate them about STEAM, so then excitement at home, not only among children, but also parents know what we have discussed at those workshops. So I would start with that, because there is really a connection between STEM and humanities, social sciences, other disciplines, and taking courses like that will help your daughters to make those connections. It is unfortunately that, especially in middle school, often young girls lose interest in STEM, and they shouldn't.
I teach undergraduate Duquesne in the School of Education and supervise student teachers. So my question is this, and I think, Justin, you alluded to the small steps we all take. What can I do with those kids that are going to become teachers? What can I do in the classroom? I teach assessment, ed psych, that kind of stuff. But what would you suggest I add to my classes to help prepare them for what you're doing and what you're seeing in terms of innovation, in terms of the half-life of facts and how schools are changing so quickly? So I guess I'll put you on the spot a little bit, but I'd just like to know what I can do tomorrow, integrate into my courses.
Yeah, so number one, I applaud Duquesne University because I work closely on an advisory team there. They're trying to do more innovation within the education department, so kudos to Duquesne University. I mean, the biggest thing is, when I hire a teacher and I interview them, I say, what do you want to do in the class? Because the first day, I'm not going to be in there. And if I give you a curriculum that says, you have to teach this, you have to do this, I'm not going to get the best from you. So my thing is, what's your strength? And it could be a teacher, a third grade language arts teacher has a background in music. So you know what? I want to teach literacy by having kids reading music notes. Let them. Because I'd rather have a lot of great teachers doing a lot of great different things than a bunch of average teachers doing what they're told to do. So that's my biggest. That's what I tell teachers all the time. Like, what do you want to do? And I going back to before, I remember my first day, and I was talking to a group of teachers, and I asked the principal, I said, what do you want to talk about? She said, I want my teachers to take risks this year. So I sat in front of the whole teaching staff. I said, we're going to take risks this year. Who wants to go first? It was like crickets. Everyone's like, I don't know. Are we allowed to do it? That was one teacher reason. I want to get rid of my furniture. I don't like my furniture. I want furniture kids can run to my class, relax, have fun. I said, done. Donors choose it is. We get you new furniture. And all of a sudden people said, I didn't know I had permission to do these things. So it's kind of unleashing that permission for not just teachers, but principals. In 2017, our high school principal is the state of the Pennsylvania principal of the year in the state of Pennsylvania. Our middle school principal and our elementary principals are awesome because they're doing what they want to do. And I think sometimes we lose that trust from teachers and principals and superintendents and say, let's just do kind of what I tell you to do and let's be safe. And I think those days have to be long, long gone. And I guarantee, I don't know about you, but if a 22, 23-year-old teacher comes to me and says, look all the stuff I could do with technology or this, what I learned, I'm looking at them thinking, wow, I thought I was good in technology. They're like so much better than me. All right, go do it, and let me know if you need help sometimes. And so I think, sometimes the master flip has to switch sometimes.
So here you're saying they need to be bold. They need to step out.
We need to encourage that step out and say, what are you good at? Let's do it.
I would add too, and this is with my Allegheny Conference hat off, but I did my undergrad in education, secondary education. And I know for me, I mean, 15 years ago, makerspaces didn't exist. But I know for me, I had one student teaching experience. That school was wildly different from where I had my first teaching experience. And so if there's a way to show, not only just bring to light the inequity that different school districts have, but how different school districts are using, you know, a lot of resources or very few resources to really be innovative. When you're 22, you're the most creative you're ever going to be, in my opinion. Yeah. So let them use that creativity. Yes. And from an educator standpoint, give them the freedom to express themselves and use their creativity. I think you come out thinking, okay, this is how I have to run a classroom, and it has to be formal, and it has to be just so, because that's what I learned in school. And so teaching them the flexibility and that creativity should be a part of the classroom, I think should be a big part of the student teaching experience that I know for me wasn't part of my experience.
Teachers will do what their principal evaluates them on, and mentors, especially 22, 23-year-old teachers, will do whatever their mentor says sometimes. I was 26 years old, my first administration job, and I wanted to do something kind of radical. My principal said, do it. I was assistant principal. He goes, do it. If it works, you get all the credit. If it doesn't work, I'll take the blame. And I was like, wow, okay. And it worked. And I was like, that. I learned that lesson, so I took that lesson and applied it to every type of leadership role I was in the whole time.
Yeah. We have one, we'll make this the last question here in the front.
So it kind of combines I had the same question about how do we prepare high school teachers or elementary teachers. You talked about it at the college level, but how do we prepare those teachers? And you just addressed that, but also we've had examples of Troy getting his office and running his business and Chartiers and having the manufacturing lab in the middle of the school. But how about the other kids? What can you do that, and how do you do that for 400 kids, every one of the 400 kids in a high school? And maybe a part of that, do you think standardized tests get in the way of these things that we need to teach, the critical thinking, the collaboration, the leadership?
I think we do it every day with 1,000 kids at the high school. They take their own classes they want to take, and teachers teach whatever they want to take by using an app and we give them the flexibility to do it. We actually have called personalized learning time. And it happens every day. But it took a huge culture shift by saying, teachers, hey, we're going to let you teach whatever you want to teach. And there's going to be no grades. And kids are going to take whatever. If kids, you want to teach a class, teach your own class. I think it's happening right now. It's going back to, like I said, the high school principal said, we're going to do this. And we're going to take a risk and see if it works. And he said, you know, he stood in front of his staff and said, I may lose my job over this. And you may lose your jobs. He said, I may lose my job. You're not going to lose your jobs doing this, so let's try it. And they all said, okay. And he said, like, you know, do you think this will be good for kids? And they all said, yeah. And I think it's going back to the core values. 3 years ago, we switched our core values for our district. Number one, putting children first. Creating a learning culture, and supporting a growth mindset. Those are our three core values, and every decision we make evolves around those. And we say, is this our core values? And if it is, then we do it. And we get support from our board, community, and I think that's important too.
It sounds like it all goes back to culture, right? Like if you have a leadership that's going to let you
culture
take these
drives
risks.
Everything.
Yeah. All right, we are going to have two more questions. I was wrong. We'll go right back here.
The newest phrase I've been seeing about the 21st century has been mental resilience. I'm sure some of you have seen that. But can we develop that characteristic of being flexible, able to deal with complexity, able to be to deal with such complex changes? Can we teach mental resilience?
That's a very good question. And I remember as a graduate of Leadership Pittsburgh, I also worked with Dr. Citrin. And he's the one who said that to me. Well, for 20 or 30 years, we all manage stress and see where we are. We're still managing it. So resilience is a very big part of our existence. The grit and resilience is really inserted into us from early age. We sometimes just do not realize that we have it. And you can certainly encourage that and you can teach that, but it also comes with probably age and maturity and, you know, life circumstances. But I think grit is a very big part of our culture, and our students are more resilient than we give them the credit.
And I'll just go real quick. So my dad was a coal miner. You know, I was went to college, and I think grit and that is, you know, we played football. I played college football. I said to my son, 11-year-old, I said, let's go play football. And he wanted to go read a book. And I was like, no, let's go play football. And so, like, as, I guess, older people, mentors or parents or teachers, like, I think it's grit to be open-minded in a way, too. That's hard. I mean, telling my dad, no, I want to go to college. Like he had to say, like fight back. And be like, oh, it's okay, you know. And I see that more of my kids and my own kids at home and school age kids. Things that I think are grit, you need to do this. They're teaching me things that, all right, maybe that does make sense. Maybe you should go read a book and not throw football with me outside. You know, and I'm thinking, I was like, yeah, you're a kid, you should be playing outside. But I don't know. I think, for me, it's kind of just being open-minded and looking at grit in a little different way sometimes.
We could have a whole forum on character education, right? Because it is happening in every classroom. But we have one more question here in the back.
Well, it's not a question. I was going to piggyback on what the gentleman said here moments ago about creating a train-to-trainer program and making it a contemporary approach that actually looks at the urban side of things and tying that into education. Also, I want to talk about the AI and the disparities also in the underserved communities. And how is that being implemented into places like Arsenal Elementary School and schools in Northside, Perry, et cetera? Because I see that paucity of African-American leadership as far as in STEAM missing. How can we implement that and what's being done?
Yeah, I could speak specifically about AI. When we launched this course, one of the things we were really intentional with was, number one, we are going to, at MIT, we're writing this ethics course. At the end of it, it's going to be all open sourced. With everything we're doing at the end of it, everything's going to be open source, free curriculum for anybody who wants to do it. We're involving the community, and we're having different people from different regions come in and talk. So, and we're having open houses. We're working with several foundations to do community forums and bring people in. We're writing, like, just like our planetarium and a lot of things. Any school district, like Langley, they came in and watched shows in our planetarium, and for free. I mean, we invite those people. We invite all these people in from all these school districts to come in, and we go out too. I think it's not like, you know, we learn best from people, not things. But as far as the AI goes, we were really intentional in making sure this is open source. And the main reason why we did it was we hear a lot of people like, oh, you need to teach AI, you need to teach this. And nobody was doing it. So we said, you know what? Let's just teach and see what happens. And if it messes up, at least we'll be able to explain to other people how to do it. But we were really intentional saying, you don't need money to do an AI program. That was really, and we worked with an organization called AI for All out of San Francisco, and their main focus are African-American women in AI, and they're a nonprofit, and we worked specifically with them to help us kind of to navigate this language and curriculum to make it open source, and they're the ones going to help make it open source, and they actually just did a summer camp at CMU, where we're going to support next year as well, to invite specifically minorities into artificial intelligence backgrounds.
It's a good note to end on. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for your questions. We love having your voice heard during these conversations. Let's have a round of applause for our panelists.
This has been a special presentation from 90.5 WESA on tomorrow's jobs for today's students. It was moderated by WESA reporter Sarah Schneider.